Hi, I'm Warren Giroux, Senior Investment Consultant with Sightline Wealth Management. We are bringing you a series of conversations with a select group of alternative investment managers Sightline works closely with. These managers specialize in private debt, private mortgages, long and short equity strategies, among others. As part of the discussion, we will touch upon governance, transparency, portfolio positioning, current strategy trends, and future opportunities in the asset class. Good afternoon. I'm Warren Giroux of Sightline Wealth Management. I'm here today with Sean Collier, CEO and CIO of HEC Investment Management. Welcome, Sean. We're glad that you're able to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the market and your thoughts on the markets, we have some general questions about the firm. What's the current AUM of HEC?
Current AUM is just over $1.05 billion.
And how many different mandates does that cover?
Covers one mandate. We have one and only fund that we manage, which is the HEC fund.
Okay. And is there a large institutional holding in that fund, or is it primarily retail?
The investor base is mixed. I'd say probably an equal split between retail and, multifamily office, single family office investors. So depending on your definition of institutional, we would class some of these multifamily offices and single family offices as institutional. Certainly, we'd be probably split right around 50-50.
Okay. Do you actually have any pension plans or endowment funds investing in the fund?
We do not. I don't want to say definitively no, because as you know, Brett knows our investor base better, and they may have came through a multifamily office or an allocator, but yeah. I don't believe directly we do not have any pensions.
I'm sure some of the family offices probably have endowments as part of their package, and they could have exposure there. So are you the sole portfolio manager, or do you have any analysts backing you up, or what's the structure of the firm as far as that goes?
Yeah, so sure. So I'm the sole PM. There's two analysts under me who make up the investment team. And then we have an operations specialist who takes care of the ops, back office settlement and whatnot. We have on the compliance side, a CCO. He has a junior that reports into him. And then obviously Brett on the business development and operation side, that Brett runs that portion of the business.
Yeah. So your growth over the last few years has been quite significant. Have you had any large withdrawals last year, for example, a year and a half ago, when the market had a bit of a pullback? Did that cause any upset?
I think we saw more activity amongst our investor base during last March. We did not see any, significant net outflows in any one month. I'd have to double check, but I believe we had net inflows for every month last year. Maybe one month we were right around flat. But there was certainly activity. Obviously, there was some trepidation among some, and then there's also some aggressiveness from some of our core relationships who understand our strategy and understood the opportunity in March and April, and we were able to communicate what we were seeing, and they actually meaningfully allocated during that time period. I'd say the activity increased, but it was pretty much business as usual and net inflows month over month.
Yeah. Are there any thoughts regarding closing the fund?
Yes, there has been. It's been, top of mind really since year three of the firm. It's something we always monitor. Brett and myself are material investors in the fund, both as a percentage of AUM in our opinion, and also certainly as a percentage of our net worth. So a return on the generated return on the assets has always been of paramount importance to us versus, you know, gathering assets to generate fee income. We monitor the opportunity set quite closely. We're in a situation now where our fund has grown, you know, we're at our peak AUM, and also our opportunity set is at the largest it's ever been, over $100 billion of SPACs currently outstanding. So it's something we monitor, something we're cognizant of, but we don't feel, given the growth, the rapid growth in our opportunity set and the opportunities we see, that we're at a point where we're close to capacity.
Yeah. The main focus of the portfolio over the last several years has been SPACs versus merger arb, because I think when I first met HEC, goes back, I don't really remember how many years now, it was, you were a fairly young firm. You were doing merger arb at the time. Is SPAC sort of the SPAC area the still this primary focus or the only focus of the fund currently?
It is not the only focus. It's become the primary focus, certainly. It has never been the only focus of the fund. We've always actively monitored and invested in the merger arb transactions we found attractive. You know, if we think back to when we initially launched in the early days of the fund, we viewed capital preservation as our most important goal for our investors. We thought if we could preserve capital, we could generate a nice return compounding over time. And that hasn't changed. That's still the number one goal for us as a firm. And when you look at SPACs on the whole, compared to risk arb on the whole, the opportunity to protect capital and generate a return is far more attractive than SPACs. Now, there is situations in the risk arb market where you can generate a really attractive return without taking much incremental risk. We invest in those situations. But currently, as things stand, we think, you know, to achieve the goals of the firm and for our LPs, the SPAC market provides a more attractive landscape than the risk arb market does.
So when you say a target return, what are you talking about? Are you looking between 7-9% or in that sort of range for both the merger arb side and the SPAC space?
You know, I think we've quoted historically 6-8% as an expected return over, you know, a multi-year period for the fund. We've always been hesitant and shied away from a target return. We don't target a number each year for our investors. You know, again, we view capital preservation as our most important job as fund managers. And, you know, we think over time, our strategy will generate a return that's, you know, 6-8 or hopefully in excess, you know, given last year was a great outlier year, that certainly helps the IRR for LPs. We've never shot for a number. We take what the market gives us. We look to protect capital at all times, and the returns will be the returns. And we think a reasonable expectation is 6-8 over time. Hopefully there's some upside to that as we saw over the last couple of years. But that's kind of our thinking, you know, regarding the return profile of the fund.
When I look at the returns of your fund, I don't particularly have them in front of me right now, but I think your worst drawdown has been what, a couple of percent or something in the history of the fund?
Yeah, it was four, I don't have the exact number, but call it, you know, just over 4.5% last March.
Okay, last March. But then you had an extreme recovery, and I think year end you were over 30%. I think, is that not
right? Yeah, over 38. Over 38.
Okay. So going forward, investors look at that 38%, and new investors might say, "Oh, I'm going to jump on board because it looks like a, you know, they've really got this market peg." What would you tell them as far as expectation of returns go? Because I know you just said your expectation is between 6-8, and you don't want to lose capital. But a lot of people might ignore that. So are you thinking that you're going to have another great year, or is it, can that be repeated last year, or is it more likely to be historic returns of 6-8?
I mean, when we look at our start this year, you know, we're up just over 8%. you know, coming into the month of May as of April 30th. We try to position ourselves in a to generate a nice risk-free return in the SPAC market, you know, create units at discounts to trust. That's risk-free in our opinion, as long as you don't run into a situation where you're a forced seller, which we work very hard to make sure we're never in that situation. I think we do a great job. I don't think we'll be in that situation. And then we try to build in these right tail events, you know, and that right tail is really strong reception to backends being announced. We're selling in excess of 10, you know, sometimes materially higher, or we're recycling the capital quicker. We model out that things will take their full timeline. If they don't, you know, if a sponsor transacts in 6 months, that obviously, you know, greatly increases IRR versus if it takes them 2 years. So, you know, the upside return is very difficult to peg. What we know is what we can do on the downside and what we can guarantee as far as a worst case scenario return. In terms of investor expectation, you know, the honest answer is I don't know. You know, if I tried to project out what occurred last year in April, if I had, you know, spoken about the euphoria we saw, people probably, or in last March, people would have laughed at me, and I probably could have never envisioned what happened. So, you know, I think we view it as guarantee a nice rate of return. You have this optionality. It may hit, it may not. Probably comes to fruition more often than people ever think. But it's not something that, you know, you can count on, and it's not something that we count on to generate a base case return for our investors.
Okay. So a few months ago, SPACs were headline news about changes the SEC were going to make regarding reporting or treatment, I guess, of warrants. Can you explain to our listeners what actually happened, how that might affect your portfolio and the current environment?
Yeah, sure. So what the technical point of what happened was SPACs, you know, issue warrants on the IPO, and those warrants were treated as equity instruments on the balance sheet. The SEC came out with guidance stating that they should be treated as liability instruments on the balance sheet. So what does that mean? You need to reclassify all this warrant, you know, the warrant from the equity portion to the liability portion. You need to go back and restate your financials, and anybody looking to, that's for SPACs that are already public. Anybody looking to come public needs to get their, you know, their pre-pricing audit done with the warrants treated as liability. That put, you know, a fork in the road for new SPACs coming public. We're of the opinion, and I think it's correct, that the media actually portrayed the slowdown incorrectly. The SPAC market was already materially slowing far before this warrant reclassification came to the forefront. There was, you know, we thought it would happen and it did. There eventually just became far too many SPACs for the number of investors. Supply completely overwhelmed demand. And that was really the closing of the SPAC market. And we think, you know, with or without the warrant coverage or warrant reclassification, we would have ended up in the same place. The warrant issue has effectively come and gone. SPACs have now reclassified them as liabilities. We're seeing new SPACs IPOs price with the warrant treated as a liability. Already public SPACs have reclassified them. Post business combination SPAC companies that are now operating companies have reclassified them. So really it was, you know, it was just a hiccup, and a way to, you know, accountants had a lot of work to do, and they did it, and I'm sure they charged a pretty penny for it. And away we go. In terms of lasting effect, we see almost no, you know, lasting effect on the product from that.
Is that reclassification changed how the has it impacted the price of the SPACs at all in the market?
No. You know, again, there's a cause and effect. SPACs have pricing on the whole has gone down. You know, the discounts to trust are wider. Warrants are trading lower than they were in February. So you know, again, we're of the opinion that that is a function of the SPAC market, not a function of what the SEC did with the warrant reclassification. There is a correlation certainly between the SEC's action and the price of common and warrants in the market. I don't think there's a causation. Maybe somebody disagrees with me, but I view it really as the market just repricing lower given the overwhelming amount of supply and the limited amount of demand.
Did that repricing give you an opportunity to maybe add to your positions at a lower price or help you adjust your ACB or improve the return profile going forward?
Yeah, so we've been running very low leverage throughout, you know, November, December, January, February. Not necessarily because we foresaw the repricing of the SPAC market occurring as hard or as quick as it did, but because the price action dictated us to run low leverage. We pride ourselves on buying below trust and selling when there's risk in the portfolio or SPACs trading above trust. A lot of SPACs are trading above trust. We were selling all those securities. So now that's flipped. We came into this very, very underlevered. We've begun the process of allocating capital, probably, you know, in select instances in March, throughout April and throughout May. And there is some very, very attractive opportunities in the SPAC market to back sponsors that we think have a high probability of achieving that right tail that we spoke about, which is, you know, a transaction trading well in excess of 10 and doing it much quicker than their allotted 2 years. We're able to buy those sponsors at, you know, very, very attractive yields, over 3% nominal yields. That's something that we just haven't seen since last March. So, you know, we're allocating capital, you know, I wouldn't say very aggressively, but we're certainly, you know, getting capital out there in the situations we like.
Have you increased your leverage, in view of that?
Our leverage has gone up. You know, it's actually, we're still lower than our historical run rate. We've typically ran right around 170% gross. I think we went as low as probably high 130s during the, you know, the period of November, December, Jan, Feb. And right now we're right around 156 okay. percent gross. So it's gone up from the lows, but.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
No, just it's up off the lows, but we still have a little bit of ways to get to our run rate.
Okay. So how many different SPACs did you have in the fund right now?
We would have over 100 positions, certainly. I mean, I don't know the exact number. If I went to my screen, I could get it, but it would be, I'd guess probably right around 140, 150 issuers.
Okay. So what would be your largest exposure?
Largest exposure would be just under 10% of the AUM to one SPAC.
Can you name that one? Or would you care to?
Sure.
That's, I mean, okay.
You know, as we're open book, it's Austerlitz, which is Bill Foley's, one of his vehicles. He's had three SPACs, four SPACs in the market. One has announced and closed, one's in the process of closing, and one just announced. So he has two more in the market, one of which is our largest position.
Yeah. So last year, there was, you know, the SPAC market was quite frothy. And I understand that some managers are having difficulty getting their full fills on new issues. Is that continuing this year, or is it easier to get a fill this year?
Yeah, so you can pretty much get any fill you want right now in the SPAC market. That's a point of differentiation for us when the market's hot. You know, we were able to get larger allocations than our peers, which we were quite happy to do and take advantage of that. That, you know, advantage has probably fallen away. These deals are not wildly oversubscribed, and often they're trading around 10 or lower on announcement. So that aspect of the market has changed. But what I would say now is we're actively in discussions with a number of bankers and sponsors about increasing the attractiveness of the structure. So, you know, putting more cash in trust, shortening the time frame, adding warrant coverage. And as quickly as all the new entrants came, they've all now left. So that leaves the players that, you know, the call it the older players or folks like ourselves with more power on pricing. So I think the days of, you know, a fifth of a warrant deals, a fourth of a warrant deals have gone for now. You know, there's a brand name private equity firm that's talking about putting 10-20 in trust along with warrant coverage and a shorter timeline. That's great. You know, we love to see that. And we're exerting our leverage in those situations to, you know, that's one of the reasons why we're not at 170, 175% levered. I think we'll be writing some large checks in the next month or two into very, very attractive structures, just given where we are in those negotiations. So, and those, you know, you might not see those trade to 10:30 right away, like you were seeing in February, but they'll get to the same place. You've structured it to a point where it has to get there. It's just, you know, the return will come over time instead of initially day one. So we're pretty excited about some of those conversations we're having.
So have you had any pushback from any of the issuers where they know you're a seller at trust or you sell prior to that at a premium? Have you had any pushback from the issuers like saying, you know, because they obviously are doing this so that people hopefully will move into the new issue equity when it's decided. Have you had any pushback on your allocations or anything, or were you having that difficulty as a trust player?
We were obviously now we're not having any pushback on allocations. They just want to get any capital. There was some sponsors who would bring in their own capital, you know, like folks like Dragoneer, they have their own LPs, you know, I'm sure CPP is a pension LP of Dragoneer. CPP also has a SPAC, you know, invests in actively in SPAC. So those relationships would, you know, limit the amount of stock for traditional investors like ourselves. Those were really one-off. You know, I think there's most sponsors and most bankers understand the value of having folks like us in it. You know, just as, you know, any investor will sell a deal they don't like, and any investor will buy a deal they like. So, you know, we've seen it time and time again, a lot of these SPACs that were allocated to quote long onlys are the ones trading the worst now, because they're not natural holders of the security. They don't understand the security and they just don't want it anymore, and they just sell it. You know, bankers understand that, the smart sponsors understand that. We were getting allocations. We weren't getting pushback uniformly, you know, maybe one or two transactions. But the good news was there was, you know, over 400. It didn't limit our ability to put capital to work. You know, I think that's just being a trusted partner with a lot of the large firms. You know, I would say we have, you know, great relationships with probably the top five or six underwriters in the stock market, and they know us and they know what we're doing. You know, again, people, you know, participants who've been in this market for a while know that there's cycles. They don't forget who's there in, you know, May of 2021, offering up terms to put 10% orders into deals, because they know that, you know, they know that will happen again. And they know the good times or the oversubscribed times will happen. So there's a give and take, and, you know, the larger, more established firms understand that. And we were treated, you know, quite well during the euphoric days.
I know last year there were some big SPACs that were in technology SPACs, I guess, got a lot of attention last year. Has there been any particular sector that's been dominating the SPAC space this year, or do you see that happening going forward?
Yeah, I mean, the SPAC space really moved into pre-revenue or early revenue type, you know, tech companies, AI companies, electric vehicle companies, electric, you know, like helicopter airplane type companies. I think that was really a function of the market demand for those companies. You know, a SPAC sponsor's job at the end of the day is to bring something the public markets want, and give investors the opportunity to buy something they otherwise couldn't have bought. That in 2020 and 2021 is, you know, probably foolish as it was, as it looks now, and as euphoric as those times were, that's what people wanted. And SPAC sponsors, to their credit, did a great job of finding those businesses and bringing them public. Now, as we know, you know, with rates rising and, you know, the rotation towards value and, you know, kind of more away from these stocks that, you know, with cash flows in later years that are, you know, their valuations dramatically affected by an increase in rates, you're seeing SPAC sponsors pivot. You know, we're seeing some interesting companies that are levered to reopening. You know, Vivid Seats is going public via SPAC. That's the number two to StubHub. And they'll say number one soon. That's got tremendous leverage to the reopening of the US economy and really the world economy. So SPAC sponsors are now starting to pivot. They understand the appetite from public market investors for near-term cash flow, near-term EBITDA, near-term revenue growth. And that's what we're seeing more and more of. And I think, you know, it'll continue to pivot that way because those are the deals that's performing well. And at the end of the day, SPAC sponsor's job is to find a deal that performs well.
So do you see rising or anticipated in increasing inflation and higher interest rates impacting the SPAC market or the structure itself?
We don't see it impacting the structure. The one really elegant thing about the structure is the trust account is invested in short-term treasury bills. So as short-term rates go up, the trust account's earning that interest, and that interest comes to shareholders. So, you know, all things being equal, our nominal returns will go up with rates going up. We'll have a little bit of a higher cost of leverage, but, you know, we're only running a half a turn. So on our equity, we're going to get the pickup of that increase in rates. So we have, you know, 100% correlation to rates increasing. So that's fine. So on the structure, no, we don't see a risk. Does that make it harder for SPAC sponsors to find attractive companies? I don't think so. You know, I think there's a recalibration going on. There will be, you know, a sector in the public markets that's underserved and probably has some scarcity value. SPAC sponsors will probably look to bring companies public to feed that demand. And people will have to pivot and they'll have to be creative. And, you know, that's why we think it's, you know, as we've mentioned, important to back the sophisticated A+ type sponsors who have the ability to pivot, the ability to put up capital, and the ability to provide expertise to the target company. And they're more than just, you know, a cash sell to quickly get public, which, you know, probably half the SPACs outstanding are only that at the moment.
Okay. I have to ask you one last question before we close off, but what's your return year to date?
Year to date, coming into this room, it would be right around 7.5%.
Okay. So basically you've had a good year's rate of return in the first, call it 5 months of the year at this point.
We have now. The only thing I'd mention is we've had, you know, we're up 7.5% on the year, but the portfolio is at an all-time wide yield to maturity. Not all time. That would have been March of last year, but call, you know, since the crisis or the crash of last March, the portfolio is at the widest yield to maturity it has been. So, you know, we feel pretty proud of the job we did during the run-up in crystallizing profits, taking off risk and redeploying it, you know, into discount or, you know, SPACs that are at a discount to 10. So while we put up a nice return, we've never had more embedded yield in the portfolio than we do right now. So we feel pretty good about where we're at now. Hopefully we have some, you know, right tail events that generate, you know, above average returns in the coming months. But if we don't, you know, we have a great, you know, discount to trust that, as you know, it's they're in at the longest time, they're 2-year bonds, and they have to accrue to trust at some point. So if we don't have those right tail events, we feel pretty good about just that accrual and what that return will look like for investors.
What would that accrual be if just a wild guess? I mean, would it be give you a return for this year of, say, closer to 10% just on an accrual basis?
Yeah, I think that would probably be fair. You know, I think we have, I'd have to see the exact, you know, the weighted average or the duration of that accrual. But I think, you know, backing out warrants and whatnot, it's the discount to trust is, or, you know, the return generated up to trust is in excess of 3.5%.
Yeah, so that's not unrealistic to think that that could happen, barring any exogenous event that might just, you know, do something to the market like we had last March.
Yeah,
of course. Just in closing, Sean, are there any other comments or thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with before we close off?
You know, not particularly. You know, I guess just the one, you know, the one thing I would mention is, you know, the media cycle is interesting. We think it's lagging, dramatically lagging. The SPAC market really turned weak in the middle of February of this year. There was media articles up until the middle of early April about the SPAC boom. The SPAC boom died at like February 17. That was when the boom ended. And there was articles, you know, speaking about it almost 2 months later. There's now articles, you know, talking about the deaths of SPAC, of you know, the death of the SPAC. It's just not what we're seeing, you know, when we speak to these sponsors. You know, we had a call with the Reinvent folks, which is, you know, Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn, Michael Thompson, the CEO. And I specifically asked this question because, you know, they're on the front lines of negotiating these deals. And I said, have you seen, you know, target companies pull back? Is there a hesitancy to using the SPAC vehicle to go public? And they actually mentioned that their deal flow is more robust now than it was when they were looking for their first two targets, which are Joby and Hippo, which they announced in February. Companies are more willing to engage now with them than they were previously. So, now that's a great sponsor, you know, and so that's a unique experience. We think it's going to become more and more important to partner with guys like that going forward, because they'll be the ones to win these high quality companies. And it's just, you know, the activity we see is very much in contradiction to the press narrative that's being crafted. So we're pretty optimistic about what that looks like, you know, over the next 9 months, what it looks like over the next month or two. You know, it's not our job to really predict that, but we're pretty optimistic about, you know, the evolution of the market and what that will mean over a cycle.
Okay. Well, why don't we leave it at that? I just want to thank you for your time, Sean. I appreciate it. And I think our listeners will have a better feeling about the SPAC space in general from your thoughts and comments. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you, Warren.